Isn't it great when you have something to look forward to, like the latest episode of this podcast, or even better, an amazing Italian getaway? Well, Explore Worldwide's new Amalfi Coast Discovery Tour is a slice of heaven. I'll be telling you more about it later in the podcast, but for now, I'll leave you with this. Their big blue sale is now on, and you'll save up to 20% on Explore's most popular small group adventures. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.
There are moments in the first draft when you just are writing and it's pouring out of you because it's this whole new story and it's coming to you from somewhere. I don't know where, a place where stories live. You find that channel and it comes into your brain, and that is a wonderful experience and moment too.
Hello, my lovely listener, and welcome to the Big Talk Book Club. It's a special series we'll dip into together each month right here on the Jessro Big Talk Show, where we still skip the small talk, but this time we're diving into the books that really stay with us, the ones that spark big feelings, juicy questions, and honest reflections. This is your backstage pass to some of the world's most celebrated authors, the storytellers whose words stay with us long after the final page. And we're going deeper than just the plot into the ideas, characters, and themes that made me reflect on my own life and maybe yours too. And the best part is you won't just be listening in. You'll have the chance to ask your own questions and be part of the conversation. So before we dive in, let me tell you a bit about the incredible author joining me today. Natasha Lester is an international best-selling author who's written 9 books of historical fiction. Natasha's novel, The Mademoiselle Alliance, is the story of Marie-Madeleine Foucaud, the only woman to lead a French resistance network in the Second World War. And I wanted to talk to Natasha about why she had to tell this extraordinary woman's story. Natasha, welcome to the Big Talk Book Club.
Thank you so much, Jess. It's so lovely to see you again.
It is great to see you again. We had a lovely experience in Kununurra at a writer's festival, and that first introduced me to your writing and your beautiful storytelling. And I really want to talk, first of all, about your latest book. It's your 9th.
I know. I can't believe that.
Either can I. It's extraordinary.
I know.
And it's called The Mademoiselle Alliance. I adored this book. It's a phenomenal read, and there was bits that made me cry. I really wept.
Oh, Jess, I should have packed some Kleenex in there for you.
I think you should have. I don't want to give too much away for our listeners, but I really marvelled at the bravery of Marie-Madeleine or Madeleine, because you're a French speaker.
Marie-Madeleine, but you can say it however
Madeleine.
You like.
And because she is really quite something. And I thought we could begin with you perhaps reading the very start of the book, where you sort of introduce readers to this extraordinary woman.
Okay. She first made contact with the outside world when she emerged, paralysed with cold and cramp, from a sealed diplomatic bag. This had been carried in the boot of a car to Madrid by a compliant Vichy courier who had crossed the Pyrenees in midwinter. Reports to London that her Nefertiti-like beauty and charm, she was then 32, mother of 2 children, were equalled by her total dedication and executive capacity proved unexaggerated. Fact had outpaced fiction in producing the copybook Beautiful Spy. This was Marie-Madeleine. And that's a quote from Commander Kenneth Cohen, who was her MI6 liaison agent during the war.
So this woman isn't just a fiction. She's not made up. She's extraordinarily brave. She headed up the alliance in France. And what you've just described there was an episode where she literally fitted herself into a mail bag. T- Tell me more about that.
I know that she did so many incredible things during the war, but that was probably one of the most extraordinary. So she had just taken over leadership of this network, and it's a network peopled by senior military men decades older than her. So she knew she had to prove herself to them. They were a little bit skeptical that this young, blonde, 30-year-old woman could lead 3,000 men in resistance during the war. But then disaster strikes, her headquarters is, the Nazis find the headquarters, they come in, they take all of her radios, all of her money. So she can no longer liaise with MI6. She can't send them intelligence. So it's this total disaster. She's like, what am I going to do? I'm trying to prove myself. And all I've proved is the exact opposite, that under my leadership, the whole network can fall into ruins. So she thinks, okay, I need to talk to MI6, get more radios, more money. Can't just pick up the telephone and call them from occupied France. So I've got to get myself to Spain, because then I can get to the British embassy in Spain and they can call MI6 for me. But how does a woman wanted by the Nazis get herself over the border from France into Spain to do this? So she comes up with this one extraordinary idea. She's got an agent who is couriering this diplomatic mailbag between the French embassy in Spain and the Vichy French embassy in Vichy. And so she says to him, tell me how big your diplomatic mailbag is, because she knows that no border officials are allowed to search diplomatic mailbags. And he says to her, it's 4 feet by 2 feet. Why? And she says, because I'm going to need to smuggle myself inside that mailbag across the border into Spain. And he looks at her and he says, you're mad. You're 5'6". You won't fit in this 4-foot by 2-foot mailbag. And so they're trying to shove her into this bag and it's just not working, obviously. And then her agent says to her, oh, I once saw a contortionist at a circus fit himself into a bag of a bit of a similar size to this. And he squatted right down, you know, butt on the ground, bent his chest over his knees and shins and tucked his head in around his ankles. You know, give that a try. So she does. And I should also mention that while she's getting herself into this full squat, she suffers from this thing called hip dysplasia, which is this very painful hip condition. So she gets herself into this squat. Her hip is agony, but she's inside the bag. However, it won't close. And they only need like a half an inch more space to get this damn bag to close. Anyway, she realizes the one thing that's taking up the space in the bag is her dress. So she gets out of the bag, takes off her clothes, squats back down again. Now the bag closes. She's inside it. Fantastic. She thinks she's got to be in there for 2 hours because that's the amount of time it takes for the train to get across the border. It's winter, it's December, you can't drive across the roads because they're all frozen and icy. So the car's got to go on a train and that takes 2 hours. And whilst it's incredibly painful, she thinks, okay, 120 minutes, I've got to do this for the sake of my network. I can count that down and make it.
I'm feeling panicky.
I know.
Listening to this, I get claustrophobic.
I know.
And just to think that she's in this tiny bag.
Exactly.
I know. In the boot of a car.
Exactly. So, yeah, so they get the bag in the car. They pile 4 car tyres up around it because the bag is a little oddly misshapen. It's got a full-grown woman inside it, not diplomatic correspondence. And her agent drives into the station and the station master comes out and says, oh, bad news. The train came early today. It's already left. You'll have to wait for the next train. And her agent, panicking, says to him, how long until the next train? And the station master says it won't be here for 8 hours. So, and Marie Madeleine, who's in the car, can hear this entire conversation and she can't just jump out of the bag and say, oh, surprise, I was hiding in here, because then the station master is going to call the police and she's going to be arrested. So she knows she's got to stay hidden inside this bag for the 8 hours it takes for the train to leave, plus the 2 hours through the tunnel. 10 hours in total, naked, no food, no water, unable to move. I don't think I could have survived that, but the intrepid Marie Madeleine did survive that horrific experience.
And she survived so much more. Can I ask you, when did you decide, I have to write about this woman? Was there a moment? How did you discover her?
I discovered her by accident, which is really how I discover most of the female heroines that I write about. I had read so many nonfiction books about the Second World War as research for my other novels, and I'd seen the names of all the famous male resistance leaders, but had never come across her name until in one book, her name was mentioned in relation to some kind of leadership role. Didn't it come out straight up and say she was the only female leader of a resistance network in France during the war, which is what she was. But I thought, oh, that's interesting. I haven't ever seen her name before, never heard of a woman having this kind of leadership role. I'll do a little bit more research. Discovered that she'd written a memoir that was published during the 1960s, ordered that from a secondhand bookshop because it was out of print now, of course. 2 months later, this battered, beaten ex-library book arrives and I'm thinking, gosh, what's inside the covers? Better be more promising than the covers promise. But as soon as I started reading her account of what she'd done during the war, I knew immediately that I had found the woman that I wanted to write about. And I don't know whether I will ever find another woman quite as remarkable as she was.
Because she is so remarkable. And I feel terrible that I had never heard of her until I read your book.
But I think that's really normal, Jess. I think nobody had heard of her really at all. And that's part of the reason why I write these stories, to just bring back these female heroes that history has forgotten all about.
And that is so much a theme throughout all of your books, that you really put the spotlight on these extraordinary women that otherwise would be just a footnote in history. What has drawn you to do that as a writer?
I think because I look back at the opportunities that I've had as a woman growing up, and I don't think I would. And whilst there's still a lot of work to do with equal rights for women, etc., I feel like I wouldn't have had the opportunities that I've had if it hadn't been for women like Marie Madeleine and the other women that I've written about, you know, fighting against all of those barriers that were put in their way every day of their lives. So it's kind of, I guess, to honour them and to thank them for giving me the opportunities that I've had, and also to highlight that, you know, the thing about historical fiction is that it shows us how far we've come, but it also shows us how far we still have to go. So that shows us there's still a bit of work to do, and hopefully it inspires us to keep doing that work and being women like Marie Madeleine. We need more of them in the world.
Oh, we do. And so you write historical fiction, you do incredible research, and as my background as a journalist, I think about dealing with facts. How do you manage facts with then filling in the gaps?
So what I do is a little bit unusual for a historical novelist. And I don't know, I feel like some people think it's slightly the wrong way to go about it. But I actually write a whole first draft without having done very much research, because I'm a bit of a chaotic writer. I plan every element of my life. My creativity thrives in chaos, and it won't let me plan a book up front. So I've got to find out what the story is. And if I do too much research up front, I find myself just writing to that research and the book becomes a little bit dry, and it's not a creative force of the imagination, which is what you want a novel to be. So once I've got that first draft, then I know, okay, this is my research blueprint. Now I've got to research to fill in the gaps in this novel. So that's when I go away overseas. My husband always jokes that I choose places to set my books in based on where I want to travel to next. That's not what I do, but, you know,
I wouldn't blame you if you did.
If you've got the choice, why not go to France? Okay. So then I head off to France and basically walk in Marie Madeleine's footsteps and go to all of the different places where she had her headquarters in France. I visit a lot of those monuments that are there now, are dedicated to the Alliance Network and the agents who lost their lives in the fight for freedom. I sit in archives for days, trawling through badly handwritten French documents. Thank goodness I look back at 13-year-old Natasha and thank goodness she decided to learn French when she was age 13, because I could not have written this book without that language skill. And then it's a matter of saying, okay, well, I have all this information and I have this story. All I need to do is put in the facts that enhance the story that I'm trying to tell.
How do you know, though, what to put in and what to leave out? Because the story of the resistance, of the Alliance movement, is such an exciting, gripping one.
Yes, and it's colossal. And that's the biggest thing with something like this. You're grappling with a network of 3,000 agents, so 3,000 characters potentially to put in a book. And of course, no novel can hold 3,000 characters. And I have to say that almost every single man's name was either Henri or Jacques. And I'm like, can you just have some more variety of names? I can't have 500 Henris in the course of my book. So you're starting to cull based on imagining a reader coming to this book. And I wanted to convey the sheer enormity of what Marie Madeleine faced and how courageous she was in facing that. So that's your goal. And that's the thing that you have in your mind the whole time when you're sifting through all of this information. And if that information doesn't convey that to the reader, then it doesn't belong in the book. And simplifying the story so that you can convey that very strong and important message to a reader. So you start to do things like condense the number of headquarters that they might have traveled to, because they probably moved location maybe 60 times over the course of the war, and 60 different small French towns is just too much for a reader to keep in their head when they're reading a 350, 400 page novel. So it's all in service of the reader being able to appreciate this story. That's how you make your decisions as a writer.
And Marie Madeleine headed up 3,000 agents. And what I found so kind of beautiful within that you reveal in the book is that they were Noah's Ark. And she gave all of her agents different code names. Now, what was hers?
And I love this about her. And it just speaks to the kind of woman she was. So Marie Madeleine was Hérisson, which is the humble hedgehog. All of her male agents have these very manly names like, Eagle and Wolf. And she is the hedgehog. And her reasoning for that was because nobody expects much of a hedgehog. It's this little spiny creature that scuttles around in the undergrowth and nobody pays any attention to it. But whenever it's threatened, it can roll itself up into a ball and give you one hell of a spike. So perfect name for someone like her.
Oh, it is. And I just thought, it was magnificent. What made me cry reading the book is her yearnings, her love for her children, but also for her great love, Leon, who is her chief of staff. Were there parts that made you cry when you were writing?
Oh my goodness, yes. Even just, so Leon Fay, who was her second in command, as you say, he left a journal of sorts in one of his prison cells. And just reading through that journal was probably the most heartbreaking thing I've ever read in my life. But also there's one scene in the book where, the Nazis did one of their most terrible things, which was to put her two children on their most wanted list. And until then, she'd been trying her hardest to keep them safe in boarding schools run by priests who'd fought during the First World War or with her mother. She'd wanted to keep them in the same country as her, even though she couldn't see them very often. But the minute the Nazis did that, she knew she had to get them out of France, that they would no longer be safe, and she could not live with herself if anything happened to her children, as you can imagine. So she got in contact with an organisation that was smuggling Jewish children across the border from France to Switzerland, and they said they would take her children across the border. She couldn't see her children before they made that move, because if she, had a meeting with her children, of course, it's like leading the Nazis straight to them. She had to stay away from them. But one of her agents organised for her to stand at the window of an apartment building at an appointed hour one morning. And she was looking down into the street, and her agent walked her two children past down on the street so that she could see them for the last time before they went across the border. Now, the children didn't know she was up there. Nobody could tell them, because nobody wanted them to glance up and kind of draw the Nazis' attention to Marie Madeleine up in the building, looking down on the street. Marie Madeleine standing at the window, and all she wants to do is to call out to her children, say, "I'm here, I love you," or give them a hug. And she can't do that. She can only stand there and watch as they walk past, not knowing how long it will be until she sees them again, because this is mid-1943. We know Paris is liberated in August 1944, but for Marie Madeleine, she has no idea. This war could go on for 10 more years for the rest of her life. And writing that scene, which really happened, That was when I bawled my eyes out because I imagined my own children, you know, your own children, Jess. Can you imagine doing that as a mother?
And that's what I find so inspiring about Marie Madeleine, that she's selfless.
Yes.
That she puts her love of her children, her great love of her life, almost not to the side, but there's this greater good that she feels she has to follow if these people are going to inherit a better world.
Yes, I agree. And I think it almost shows just how much she loved her children, that she was able to want that future for them more so than the immediateness of a hug. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like it's an even bigger love.
Yeah. Which I couldn't
do. No, no. I just want the hug. Oh, yeah. She was amazing.
And even more so when you think about the time that she was born into, that women were not encouraged to use their voice, to behave in that way.
Oh, absolutely. She really was operating at the very edge of what it was to be a woman in that time, which she'd kind of done all through her life. You know, she had this very exotic childhood growing up in Shanghai and then moving to Morocco as a young 18-year-old bride. And she'd been a rally car driver, she'd been a pilot, she was a journalist, she also was raising these two children alone as a single mother. So she had really operated at that edge for quite a long time in her life. So then to step into this role that was also very unusual and uncommon for a woman, you know, for her was probably, okay, well, I can do this because I've had all these other experiences where people have judged me as being a little bit out of the ordinary.
A part that made me angry reading the book was she doesn't get the recognition.
Yeah, I know.
That she deserves. And she really still hasn't got that recognition.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? So during the war, Charles de Gaulle created this order of the Compagnon de la Libération. And these were the people he believed had fought the hardest for France's freedom during the war. And he named 1,038 people as part of his compagnon. 1,032 of them were men. So he believed that only 6 women had fought valiantly for France's freedom during the war, which obviously is incorrect. And none of those 6 women were Marie Madeleine Foucard, despite the fact that she led the largest resistance network in France for 4 years. But 2 of her male subordinates were on the list. So 2 men who were doing what they did because she was giving them orders and directions and, you know, telling them what to do were deemed to be more courageous than she was, which just seems wrong.
And even her, you, as part of your research for the book, you went to visit her where she's buried.
Yes.
And even her gravestone.
Yes. That was one of the probably saddest and most enraging experiences of my life, I have to say. I went to Père Lachaise Cemetery, which is obviously that very famous cemetery in Paris where people like Oscar Wilde and Edith Piaf and Jim Morrison of The Doors are all buried. Such a famous tourist landmark that they have a map. And on that map is marked the graves of all the famous people buried there. But of course, our intrepid Marie Madeleine Foucard is not considered famous enough to be on that map. So I had to find her grave all by myself. And that cemetery is enormous. So it took much traipsing around to come across this monument that I had a photograph of, thank goodness, which showed these 2 stone angels. And that was how I was able to identify the tomb. It's a family tomb. On that tomb, you can see the names of her mother and her father. You can see the name of her second husband from after the war. And then on the other side of the grave is this blank space. And the only text that's still legible in that blank space is a birth and death date. And that is the birth date of Marie Madeleine and the death date of Marie Madeleine. But her name has been so eroded by time and weather that you can no longer read her name on her own grave. And it's like this terrible metaphor of the way she's been erased from the pages of the history books. And standing there, first of all, I felt immensely sad. And then I felt this incredible rage that how dare the universe have done this to this incredible woman. So that was when I thought, right, take this feeling back with you to Perth and sit down in your office and write this book.
Remember your next international getaway dream can come true with Explore Worldwide's Big Blue Sail. Their small group adventures allow you to really connect with the culture, not just tick off the sights. Explore Worldwide's expert tour leaders get you closer to the colour of Morocco, the peaceful beauty of Japan, or the hidden gems under the glorious Italian sunshine. And with their Big Blue Sail on now, you'll save up to 20% on Explore's most popular small group adventures. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.
Can you share with our listeners what it meant to be a New York Times bestselling author, how you actually got on that list?
Oh my gosh, that was one of the most amazing, mind-blowing experiences of my life. So I had published, it was my second book that had come out in the US, a book called The French Photographer here in Australia, called The Paris Orphan in the US. They changed the titles for reasons we won't go into. And I thought, you know, some people might buy it. That would be lovely, fabulous. I was just so delighted to be published in America, in a different market, to start getting readers from the other side of the world. And then in my email inbox at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday, because the list is published on a Wednesday evening in America, which equates to our 6 a.m. Thursday morning, this email pops up and the subject line is New York Times bestseller list. And I'm thinking, why is my editor sending me that email? And I open it up and she says, oh my goodness, The Paris Orphan is number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. This is fabulous, exclamation marks everywhere. Editors never use exclamation marks, so you know it's exciting when they do. And then she writes at the bottom of the email, so you can cross that one off your bucket list. And I had to email back and say, I never even had it on my bucket list, because the idea of an author from Perth, Australia, ever being on the New York Times bestseller list seemed so unlikely to ever happen that I'd never been brave enough to write it down. But do you know what I did? I went and got a list and I wrote it on there just so I could have the satisfaction of crossing it off.
Going, tick.
Yep.
You've done it. And I mean, what an amazing achievement for you. But, you know, you keep writing these amazing bestsellers. I have some questions now from our listeners.
Oh, fabulous.
And Nicole is asking, what part of the writing process do you love the most?
So I don't like writing first drafts, because there's so much of the story that's unknown. It's this big, scary thing. And you start writing and thinking, oh, what if it doesn't work out? I'm so full of doubt in that first draft. So what I love is about the second or third draft, when you've got the story there, you've done the research, so you know everything. And now your job is just to make it the best possible version of that story. And that's where I feel really comfortable and totally in the zone. I do also love, there are moments in the first draft when you just are writing and it's pouring out of you, because it's this whole new story and it's coming to you from somewhere in the universe. I don't know where, the place where stories live, you find that channel and it comes into your brain and it starts coming out of your hands. And that is a wonderful experience and moment too.
I want to hear more about that channel.
I know. I wish I could access that channel all the time. I think that, you know, there's so many pieces of advice that say, you know, the inspiration will never come unless you sit down at the desk. And I think that's true. But I also do think you can create the circumstances to encourage that to come to you. You know, Elizabeth Gilbert in her book Big Magic talks about getting dressed up and putting on perfume to seduce the muse. And whilst I don't go that far, I've just been down at my beach house in Busselton, which has got this gorgeous view of the ocean from my desk. And I always think sitting, looking at water, for some reason, that's my channel to the universe of stories. And that's where they come. I had the most productive time down there. So going for long walks, not being at the desk, letting the ideas just come in as you're doing something slow and meditative, like walking, having a beautiful view, and of course, a cup of tea, very important.
All those different sorts of factors that come into
yep.
it. Because of course, with your writing, this was a career that you came to slightly later in
yes.
your life, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. So I had wanted to be a writer since I started reading and since I understood writers wrote books. But when I left Year 12 back in Perth, none of the universities offered creative writing programs at that time. So I had no idea how to be a writer. All I knew about writers was that they starved in garrets, and that did not sound like a very appealing proposition. So I asked my dad, which, you know, he's an accountant. Should a wannabe writer ask an accountant for career advice? No. So unsurprisingly, he suggested I do a Bachelor of Commerce, which I did because I discovered it had this component called marketing and public relations, which had a writing element to it, albeit in the corporate world. So I did that for a number of years, ended up working in Melbourne for L'Oreal Paris as marketing manager for Maybelline, had more lipsticks than any young woman could ever use in an entire lifetime. It was fabulous. I loved it. But I still had that writing dream in the back of my head. So my husband had followed me across Australia for my job. When he had to relocate back to Perth for his job, it seemed only fair that I went with him, which meant quitting my fabulous job with Maybelline. And I decided that that was one of those moments I don't think you get very often in your life where you can choose a different path to the path that you have just been following. And I said, okay, I'm going to go back to university now because there are creative writing courses now, and I'm going to do something about that dream that I have always had to be a writer. So I enrolled in a Master of Creative Arts, wrote my first book as my master's thesis, was very, very lucky to win an award for that book, which got published, and I have been writing ever since.
You say lucky, but in fact, it takes talent and grit to write.
It does. I always say there's a combination of three factors that make you a writer. One of those is to have some affinity with language, some ability to, you know, make sentences that appeal to people. Some of it is hard work, but there is, I think, in writing and the publishing world, a little luck factor that does come into play. So long as you do the hard work and cultivate that talent by reading widely, voraciously, then the luck will come.
You mentioned affinity for language. Something that really resonated with me in the Mademoiselle Alliance is all of the stars and the moon. And as my daughter told me, that celestial imagery, Mum. But I really, that's something that awakens something in me.
Oh, look, I'm so glad you said that, Jess, because I love really full, voluptuous books.
Yes.
I just like the way you dress. You know, you're big and bold and vibrant, and that's the kind of language that I love to include when I'm writing. So when I'm reading books like that, they really, you know, trigger something in me. And I think I've internalized all of that love for those kinds of words, so they flow out when I'm writing too.
Oh, and when there's sort of the yearning of love and things, that was when I really wept because I thought, oh. Now, Janine, another one of our listeners, asks, what books are on your bedside table right now?
Okay, well, I'm very lucky to be reading an early copy of a book called The Heir Apparent, I think it's called. It's coming out next year by Rebecca Armitage, an current ABC journalist, and it is extraordinary, but you can't buy that one at the moment, so don't run out and get that one at the moment. I've just finished Atmosphere by Taylor Jenkins Reid, about this beautiful love story set during the first women exploring space in the 1980s. And it's fabulous. She is a writer at the top of her game. So I thoroughly recommend that one.
Well, she's like you.
Thank you, Jess.
She is. What novel, this is a question from Sarah, was the most difficult to write?
The Mademoiselle Alliance was, just because of the sheer quantity of information and also the obligation I felt to the 439 agents of Alliance who gave up their lives in the fight for freedom. You never want to lose sight of the trauma and the sheer heroism. You know, we use the word hero so lightly these days, but their heroism in being so selfless as to give up their lives for future generations who they would never meet and who would never know their names. You know, nobody knows the names of those 439 agents who died. And that's the biggest tragedy of all. So it was hard because of wanting to make sure I honoured them in the right way and never minimised or trivialised what they did just because I was writing a novel, you know, a work of fiction, not a work of fact, but also just, you know, coping with so many names and so many people and so many places and so much research. But I'm so glad that I persevered and wrote the book, particularly right now, I think, Jess, Because Marie Madeleine was just an ordinary woman like you or I. She didn't have formal military training or training in intelligence. And it just shows that what one ordinary woman can do if she sets her mind to it. And like, that's a great story that we could all use right now, surely.
Oh, now more than ever.
Yeah.
As you say, though, it's the responsibility, isn't it?
Yes.
As a writer, you want to really do justice to this story.
Yes. Yeah. And you are constantly, you know, when you're writing, half of you is so full of doubt and that all of those things attached to that doubt and kind of try and press you down and make you, you know, unable to write. But then the other half of you has got to be stronger than that and lift you up out of the chair and go, no, you can write this book.
And I'm so glad you did. Just our final question from a listener. This is from Amy. And she asks, what does your typical writing day look like?
Okay, so I always go for a run in the morning. I consider a run to be a part of my writing practice because I always have lots of ideas for characters and dialogue when I'm out pounding the pavements. Then I come back to my desk after the kids have gotten off to school, make myself a cup of tea, and I start to write in half-hour blocks because writing is very bad for your back, as I've discovered over the years. You have to get up after half an hour and move around. And it's also just good to move away from the page sometimes when you're a little bit stuck. Coming back to it after 10 minutes, suddenly you know the answer to whatever it was you were stuck on. So that's essentially my whole very dull, boring day, writing in half-hour blocks, 10-minute break in between, lots of cups of tea, and very unglamorous. I love getting out from behind the desk and doing interviews because I get to put on some nice clothes and talk to human beings rather than imaginary people.
So it's hard work and you're very disciplined with it.
Yes.
With that sort of, because even when I first met you, I remember you were saying, oh no, I'm going now because I've got to go and write for an hour or two. And I marveled at that sort of, that discipline to know, regardless of where I am, I have to go and do this writing.
Yes, and I think you have to be like that. I remember, I think it might have been Elizabeth Gilbert, in fact, who was talking about the one most powerful tool in a writer's arsenal is a humble kitchen timer. And she would take it with her on tour, and no matter what, in an airport, departure lounge, or in the back of a taxi, or after an event at night, she would do a half an hour of writing every day. Because as she said, in a half an hour, you can get out a couple of hundred words, and that's better than 0 words. And every day of writing for half an hour means that at some point you'll have a book. So I kind of adhere to that idea and I think it's a great one of hers.
Natasha Lester, thank you so much for talking with us on the book club, but also introducing us to the extraordinary Marie Madeleine in the Mademoiselle Alliance.
Oh, thank you so much, Jess. It's been lovely to see you again and to chat to you today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, now it is time to explore, because now it's time to tell you a little bit more about Explore Worldwide's new Amalfi Coast Discovery Tour. Imagine lemon groves, little cliffside villages, staying in a family-run hotel where the pasta is definitely better than anything you've made at home. Even better, it can all be yours for less, with up to 20% off in Explore Worldwide's Big Blue Sale on now. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.